from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The latest bomb scare story out of the Arabian Peninsula just got wilder as it went. First, word of a foiled underwear bomb plot aimed at U.S.-bound airlines. Then, the story of a double agent who went to the heart of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, posed as a would-be suicide bomber, and brought out the bomb whole. Now, it's in an FBI lab in Quantico, Virginia, and we've all got questions. This hour on Point, the plot, the sting, and the reality now of Al-Qaeda's capacity to land a blow. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the story all over the news today, and what do you make of the threat now? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Brian Bennett, national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Brian, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be on the show, Tom.
This story came out in sort of in phases, and the first thing we heard was about a plot for U.S.-bound airliners, but the double agent piece came later. How did this spill out, and why in layers like this, Brian?
That's right. Well, the Associated Press found out that the CIA had intercepted a bomb and foiled a plot to target U.S. aviation with a bomb that was able to evade security measures. And it raised a lot of questions, and we started asking around and trying to figure out how the CIA did it. Also, there were a lot of questions about where was the bomber. If the CIA was able to get a hold of the bomb, then what about the individual who was going to actually smuggle the bomb onto an airplane?
Yeah.
And as we continued to ask questions, we found out that the story was really right out of a Hollywood script.
A script of a double agent and right on down, and people have been wondering about how that came out, the cost of it coming out. We'll look at the details. Here was GOP Congressman Peter King of New York talking with Anderson Cooper last night on CNN about the revelations and the sting in the first place. Here's Peter King.
I will say this is one of the most sophisticated and successful intelligence operations that I've been aware of. I've never seen anything so tightly held. It was held as close as anything I've ever seen. And that's why the leak, when it broke, I guess, about a week ago, really put a lot at risk, including human lives. And even now, the fact that it's coming out can be dangerous.
So let's understand what happened here. Who was this double agent? Who exactly was he working for? What do we know at this point, Brian? And how did he get into Yemen in the middle of Al-Qaeda?
So the U.S. officials have told us that Saudi intelligence had an informant that they had posed as a volunteer suicide bomber and went to Al-Qaeda in Yemen, and the bomb-making factory for Al-Qaeda in Yemen made a bomb, and it made its way to this Saudi intelligence informant because they had convinced Al-Qaeda in Yemen that he was going to be willing to carry this bomb onto an aircraft.
Was he Saudi? Do we know his nationality?
We don't know the nationality of the informant at the moment, and it's some organizations have reported that he is of Saudi nationality.
We do know he was very persuasive. They accepted his story that he was a ready and willing suicide bomber and let him get his hands on the bomb itself and take it away.
This is what makes this story so extraordinary, because infiltrating a bomb-making network like this is very, very difficult, particularly Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which knows that it's under a tremendous amount of scrutiny and has proven ambitions to attack the United States. And these stories coming out, I'm sure, have put that organization into turmoil and in Yemen. And a lot of the operators, I'm sure, are questioning each other's loyalty.
Now, when did the U.S. learn that all this was going on? When did they learn that there had been a plot? When did he come out with the bomb? Do we know?
It's unclear. Sometime over the last week or two, the U.S. Was aware that these bombs were being, and at least a bomb was being made in Yemen, and that it was being brought to this Saudi informant. And sometime last week, officials have told us the Saudi informant got a hold of the bomb and then brought it to a country outside of Yemen, and it was eventually handed over to the United States and the FBI.
But we were hearing, and I don't know, there's a lot flying around right now, but that all the way back much earlier in April, there was some awareness of this, so that the Obama administration was careful in its wording as the Osama bin Laden killing anniversary approached about the safety of the skies, that it was sort of carefully parsing its statements to take into account this plot.
That's right. Well, what was curious about the language about whether or not there was a threat time for the anniversary of the death of Osama bin Laden was that U.S. officials say that at no time with this plot was the bomb out of their control. So they felt like they had put forward an informant who would be the bomber, that they were tracking the bomb, they knew the location of the bomb, and so that's why high-level administration officials have said publicly that at no point was there a threat to U.S. aviation as this, a direct threat to U.S. aviation or a viable plot as this plot was unwinding itself.
Who was this reported double agent reportedly controlled by, the CIA or Saudi intelligence? Who was he reporting to?
Well, we've been told that he was controlled directly by Saudi intelligence. This was a Saudi intelligence operation, worked closely with the CIA. The CIA and Saudi intelligence have increased their cooperation and ties over the last several years, and have had a number of successful operations, including finding out about the cargo bomb packages in the fall of 2010. If you remember, these were bombs that were hidden inside printer cartridges and shipped to destinations in the United States. That plot was because of a tip from Saudi intelligence.
There's been a lot of talk about this al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula bomb maker, master bomb maker he's called, I don't know, but Ibrahim Hassan al-Asiri. Do we know if the double agent was actually with him?
What we're told is that the double agent did not get close to Asiri, but Asiri was definitely one of the targets of the intelligence operation. And my understanding is that that this operation generated a lot of new information just because of the nature of having an informant go into the network. But he didn't get close to Asiri, the bomb maker. But Pete King said publicly on CNN that this operation did lead to getting the location of another operative who was killed in the drone strike on Sunday.
This is Fahd Mohammed Ahmed Al-Kusso, who was suspected behind the bombing of the USS Cole back in 2000. A drone hit him as he stepped out of his car in some remote valley in Yemen. He's reportedly dead.
That's right. And U.S. officials we've spoken with said that the information to locate him and send the missile from a drone that killed him came out of the Saudi intelligence operation to run a double agent inside al-Qaeda's network inside Yemen.
We heard the Republican Congressman Peter King saying that the word of this becoming public may have compromised an important operation. What are people saying about that?
U.S. officials have told us that that when the AP came to them and said that they had this operation, it had this information, that it did put the operation in jeopardy, and the AP said that they ran the story only after they received assurances from the U.S. that that there were no more security concerns, and that the operative, for example, had been taken out of the country, and the operation had been completed. But U.S. officials have told us that if this hadn't come out in the press, that they probably would never have made an announcement about this operation.
And yet the bomb out, they're looking at it now. We read here that it is in the U.S., at Quantico, in the FBI lab there. What are they hoping to learn from this bomb?
Well, there's a lot to learn about how the bomb makers working in Yemen for al-Qaeda are changing their methods, trying to design bombs that can make it through airport screening. So this bomb, for example, was designed to pass through a metal detector because it didn't have any metal parts, and was a piece of PETN explosive and a non-metallic detonator that was attached to it, designed to be worn inside a passenger's underwear.
This is a powerful military explosive. We're reading people saying this would have brought down an airliner. Is that what you're hearing as well?
It is, in the quantity that can be smuggled inside the groin area. The person would have to be, I'm told by bomb experts, the person would have to be close to the fuselage, the outer shell of the airplane for it to blast a hole in it, but it could take down an airplane.
What do you make of it? I mean, it seems so gutsy for somebody to have the nerve to walk right into kind of al-Qaeda Central in Yemen, sign up for this, and take the thing away. Is this an? Do we have any idea? Is this just? It's obviously a gutsy agent here, but could it also be a sign of Al Qaeda's desperation to find somebody to carry these? He came to them. He said he had a U.S. visa in his passport. You know, is it a desperation sign or a gutsy sign on the agent side, or both?
Probably both. And certainly, Al Qaeda's networks have been thrown in disarray by a series of targeted drone strikes and intelligence operation over the last few years. And so, you know, they're probably scraping the bottom of the barrel to try to find operatives to do these types of operations. And on top of that, sure, the U.S. is knows that Al Qaeda is intent, Al Qaeda in Yemen is intent on launching these attacks, and we've seen that their focus on airplanes, and we've seen their focus on these types of specially designed bombs that are designed to pass through detection systems.
We've got, or the FBI has this bomb, we're told, in Quantico, but does anybody know how many more like it might be out there, Brian?
Well, that is a question that, you know, members of Congress have brought up. We don't know if there are other bombs. Some U.S. officials we spoke with said that usually Al-Qaeda in Yemen doesn't just make one of these bombs. They make a few of these bombs and then try to trickle them out of the country. So it's possible that there are other bombs like this out there. But the other thing that this operation shows is that the U.S. is, and Saudi intelligence and other intelligence agencies are intent on trying to find out where these operations are and have had some success at penetrating the network in the past.
Brian Bennett, national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Brian, thank you very much for being with us today.
Happy to be on the show.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the double agent who reportedly foiled an Al-Qaeda bomb plot, the latest bomb plot there, and where Al-Qaeda's terror capacity really stands now. Here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton yesterday in New Delhi at a news conference there, telling reporters that although this plot had been foiled, the U.S. cannot relax its counterterrorism efforts.
The device did not appear to pose a threat to the public air service, but the plot itself indicates that these terrorists keep trying. They keep trying to devise more and more perverse and terrible ways to kill innocent people.
Joining us now from Washington, two big terror watchers with a lot of history. Bruce Hoffman is here, director of the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University, professor at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service, senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He was scholar in residence for counterterrorism at the CIA from 2004 to 2006. He's been studying terrorism and advising on U.S. policy for 30 years. Bruce Hoffman, thanks very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
And from Washington, Philip Mudd, senior research fellow in the Counterterrorism Strategy Initiative at the New America Foundation. He ran the CIA's Counterterrorist Center from 2003 to 2005, was deputy director of the National Security Branch at the FBI from 2005 to 2010, spent decades in the CIA, the region, and at the top levels of U.S. security circles. Philip Mudd, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let me come first to each of you, and I'll come first to you, Bruce. Do you believe this story as we're hearing it? Does it sound, you know, we've learned to listen, and it's not that we necessarily doubt, but things can be spun. Are you buying what we're hearing?
I am buying it. I think that it rings true on multiple levels. You know, I'm reminded 30 years ago or so when I was living in Israel, Meir Amit, who was the head of military intelligence, was interviewed about a John le Carré book that had just come out, and he said, always the fact is invariably more interesting and more intriguing than the fiction. And that's why I think this story on many levels rings true. I don't think we have the complete full picture, but from what we know, it sounds right.
Philip Mudd, same question to you. You know the region well, the CIA well. Does it sound credible?
It sounds credible to me. One of the surprises to me here, though, is that so many people are viewing this as some sort of unique operation. If you look at how intelligence works, it's a combination of technical information, things like phone intercepts, human information, friendships with foreign security services. If you remember the takedown of the architect of 9/11, that was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. That was a human source penetration of Al-Qaeda years ago. So I look at this and say, it sounds like what I saw at the table when I was at CIA a few years ago, and I don't view it as particularly unique.
So, I mean, Bruce says it sounds credible. You say the same. But to a lot of lay listeners out here, it can sound kind of incredible. for a Saudi agent to walk right into the middle of Al-Qaeda in Yemen and say, here I am. I mean, that seems like it takes just an unbelievable amount of nerve to go for the bomb, carry it out. You're saying that's day in and day out?
I wouldn't say day in, day out, but we had Al-Qaeda penetrations going back years that were devastating for the organization. As Bruce said, I think there are some pieces here that have not been written yet. One is how the source establishes bona fides, how someone gets into Al-Qaeda, because my experience with the organization is their counterintelligence is quite good, and they are brutal in trying to weed out and murder people that they think are informing on them. So I think one piece of this will be how he got in. And the second piece will be not about the plot, but about the plotters. When is Asiri going to go down, the fellow who made the bomb? Because I'm sure if you're on the inside, the question now isn't necessarily just how you stop the next underwear bomb. It's how you stop the bomb maker.
Everybody surely would like to do that. They reportedly, though, the agent did not actually get close to him. I mean, how do you picture what's going on there in Yemen? I mean, they got this, the other guy who was allegedly behind the USS Cole, drone from the sky, boom, he's gone. How do you picture how this operation works at this point in Yemen, Philip?
I think people are probably debriefing the individual and looking to other sources of intelligence, presumably, for example, other human sources, technical information, and doing the same kind of geolocational work that took out the operational leader of Al-Qaeda in Yemen on Sunday. My guess would be, if you're in Vegas making a bet, the fellow who's the bomb maker has a year or less to live.
Bruce Hoffman, we see that Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula itself, this offshoot from the original, bragging in its online magazine recently about all the explosive material that it has scooped up in Yemen as the government fell apart. They're saying, you know, we're loaded with the raw materials to make bombs here. What about their capacity to make explosives now, Bruce, out of Yemen?
Well, I think their operational capacity is excessively being eroded by the U.S. drone strikes, by our targeting of their leadership, the killing not only of Al-Qusso this past weekend, but of course Anwar al-Awlaki. But at the same time, what we see is that firstly, the terrorist groups that were on the periphery of Al-Qaeda have actually become stronger than Al-Qaeda Central itself. And secondly, that they have the equipment or the bomb-making materials. They've certainly over the past year consolidated their position in Yemen over larger swaths of territory, and they certainly have the determination and the motivation to carry out these attacks. And as Philip was saying, there's very few of these evil geniuses, fortunately, in sort of the annals of terrorism. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was certainly one of them. KSM's nephew, Ramzi Ahmed Youssef, the architect of the first World Trade Center bombing, was another. And certainly Ibrahim Hassan al-Asiri is the next. And you know, taking him out of the picture would indeed be a game changer. It's not going to end the terrorism threat, but that would be about the biggest setback we could deal to AQAP. In fact, a much bigger one, I would argue, than the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki was.
Philip, Matt, I want to bring that to you, but I want to put the news that we're hearing in the last 24 hours, or a little more than that, I guess, up against what we were hearing from the President, Obama, just last week in Kabul. He flew there, had the speech to the nation from Bagram Air Base, and talking about the struggle with the Taliban, but also with Al-Qaeda in particular.
Over the last 3 years, the tide has turned. We broke the Taliban's momentum. We've built strong Afghan security forces. We devastated Al-Qaeda's leadership, taking out over 20 of their top 30 leaders. And 1 year ago, from a base here in Afghanistan, our troops launched the operation that killed Osama bin Laden. The goal that I set, to defeat Al-Qaeda and deny it a chance to rebuild, is now within our reach.
Within our reach. What does this latest attack say about the credibility of that claim by the president, Philip Mudd?
I think the claim is credible, not for political purposes, but just, I mean, I'm a career analyst. I look at how he's analyzing the problem and what people are telling him, and there's a simple way to understand this. The American people see Al-Qaeda as a terrorist group. It is not. It is a revolutionary movement that was sparked by the group led by bin Laden, to try to inspire a group of people, a wave of people around the world to take the baton and stage attacks in places like Yemen or Somalia or Algeria or Nigeria. So the people who sparked the revolution, the core people who conducted the attacks of 9/11 are disappearing. The core Al-Qaeda group, as we call them, in the Pakistani tribal areas, is decimated. The problem is, and I'll close on this, the revolution had metastasized by the time we got there. We got there too late. So the people picking up the baton, even as we destroy the group in Pakistan, are now the key actors, people in places like Yemen.
Well, but what is the revolution? We thought the revolution sort of gone elsewhere, gone to Tahrir Square, left al-Qaeda behind. It had been sort of overtaken by history, Philip.
It has left al-Qaeda behind in places like Tunisia and Egypt. I suspect it'll leave al-Qaeda behind in Syria, but there are still many people around the world in places like Indonesia, northern Nigeria, Yemen, who believe that a return to the caliphate, a return to religious rule, is the only way to live. And these people are so ideologically inspired that they believe the use of violence to murder innocents is the right step. There are a lot of them out there still.
Bruce Hoffman, the administration, Obama administration, has talked about al-Qaeda being on the road to strategic defeat. Now, that's a sentence that can use the word defeat, but when you say strategic, it's so broad, there could be a lot of operations within that that still go on. But what about that claim and up against this example of continued determination and increased sophistication to carry out attacks?
Well, firstly, al-Qaeda, I think, has ceased to become a monolithic entity. It's spawned a number of affiliates, associates that are tied to the original group, but as the original group, I think, has been hammered by U.S. forces in the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, a lot of the operational capabilities have migrated to these franchises. So al-Qaeda Central, the core, may be on the verge of strategic defeat, but we see these other groups not only picking up momentum, but having entrenched themselves in their local environment. I think for all terrorist groups, including al-Qaeda core and the affiliates, they pin their faith and hopes that one successful dramatic terrorist operation, for instance, the in-flight bombing of an aircraft, is going to suddenly reverse their fortunes, will once again catapult them into the limelight, will once again generate the same global fear and anxiety that was so palpable after September 11th, 2001. And that's basically the odds that they're gambling on. And they're hoping that, despite the president's statement, which you know is accurate, at the same time they're hoping that they can reverse that tide through one terrorist incident, and that's why they'll keep trying.
Because it's high profile. Let's go to our listeners. Bruce Hoffman, Philip Mudd, please stand by in Washington. Daryl in Nashville, Tennessee. Daryl, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, how are you today?
Okay.
I just wanted to make the comment that it was a great idea and was quite brilliant, but I think that the media is sometimes too zealous in wanting to report such things. Honestly, I think they should have used a little disinformation and held the story back for a few weeks and continued to use this operative. You know, maybe send them to Guantanamo and get some more information. Sometimes, like I say, we have an opportunity, but because of our freedom of speech, you know, it can kind of shoot us in the foot.
Yeah, Daryl, let us pick that up. Philip Mudd, what do you say to that observation?
I think there's some truth to that, but with caveats. I mean, when I was at the agency, I spent a fair amount of time with the media trying to persuade them not to run stories. I mean, they have a responsibility to report to the American people. I understand that. But we had a responsibility to protect information so you could run sources like this over the long term. My point here, and the reason I talked about a caveat earlier, is the lifespan of a source like this is fairly limited. For example, he gets the device. That device clearly is not going to explode an aircraft.
Right.
And somebody in al-Qaeda is going to say, hey,
so he's done anyway.
What happened? Mm-hmm. Potentially. But remember, this is the counterterrorism business outside the security agents in Washington is about plots. People talk about taking out aircraft, taking out trains. When I was on the inside, the counterterrorism business is about people. The people business in this plot is not done. The bomb maker is still out there. So my key question is, by revealing the source, did we lose a chance to get the bomb maker? And that I don't know.
Bruce, what do you think?
Well, it was very unfortunate that the information was leaked in the first place, but I think things like this sometimes are inevitable, especially when you're dealing with multiple services, when you're operating in multiple countries, someone's going to try to take credit for it.
But wouldn't al-Qaeda, as Philip says, already know? The guy takes the bomb, he walks out of Yemen, it never goes off. They surely would suspect that he might not have been for real.
No, absolutely. But I think the more time that the intelligence agencies have to work with that information in the shadows without it being thrown into the limelight still gives them the opportunity, as Philip said, to at least trace some of the paths back to the master bomb maker who was responsible for it. I mean, that, of course, is now blown.
Let me ask you, though, about who's really zealous here in putting out these stories. I mean, as Americans have heard over the last years now, story after story after story of intercepted plots. And I don't, my impression from the outside is that the FBI and CIA are often, they appear eager to talk about these stories as a display of competence, or maybe so that if something eventually does blow up, we'll look back and say, well, they stopped a lot of others. I mean, Philip, the security agencies seem eager to talk about these stories in general.
I'm not sure I'd use the word eager, though. I fully accept that people like me would want to get out and say, hey, we spend a lot of taxpayer money, and especially after 9-1-1, when everybody was tuning into the media saying, what's going on? When is the next threat coming in? I thought we had a responsibility to tell people not only how to think about threat, but also how their money was being spent. You know, after all, they do elect the people who tell us what to do, and they do give us the money that allow us to run operations. So in a sense, it's part of democratic society for someone who serves in government to say, if you're paying for us, here's how to understand why you're getting money for your buck.
Let's go to Michael in Boston. Michael, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. So here's the question I have. So the plan of the underwear bomber was to set off a bomb and take down an airplane and crash it or blow it up or whatever. Mm-hmm. What we learned on 9/11 is that what's special about airplanes is that they can be taken over and crashed into other things. If the plan is just to blow up an airplane, why are airplanes, like, so special? Why are they putting so much effort into blowing up airplanes instead of, you know, shopping malls or hospitals or, like, much less secure spaces?
Bruce Hoffman, what do you say?
That's a very good question. Interestingly, throughout the history of modern terrorism since the late 1960s, terrorists have always been obsessed with blowing up airplanes or attacking aircraft. The reasons are, firstly, they're national symbols. Secondly, they're accessible because they carry the public. Thirdly, you gather at least a couple of hundred persons in one place, and you can engineer a very tragic event if you're sufficiently clever. And then I think most importantly is the repercussions the terrorists hope to achieve. It gets lots of publicity and attention. It has this almost a very profound psychological effect where people become afraid to fly, where this vicarious sense that, you know, but for the grace of God, there I go. And they understand that attacking commercial aviation can have an often very profound effect on national economies. So it's all those things that I think, as just as you described, against all the listener described, against all logic, they remain absolutely fixated on this target. What's fascinating is over the past decade, certainly throughout the world, commercial aviation security measures have exponentially improved. It's far more difficult now than it's ever been to target commercial aircraft. But isn't it interesting that our enemies are so implacable, are so determined over this one issue, is that they're not deterred. And they're still desperate, as we see from the example of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, to still come up with ways of penetrating those defenses.
Philip, who wins this game ultimately? They're getting more sophisticated. We're told this was a real advance over the last time they came out with an underwear bomb. But, I mean, already this bomb maker's brother tried to take one inside his body right into the middle of Saudi intelligence. What's to stop them from surgically implanting something in someone that, you know, that looks like a pancreas? But it's not. It's a bomb, and boom, it goes.
The answer is there's nothing to stop for that, and I would anticipate we will get hit one day. The question is not at this point whether we're going to get hit. I think the question is how we respond to it. 10 years ago, al-Qaeda had the initiative. We were on the back foot. Today, they're on the back foot, and the question is going to be when they take an airliner down or hit a bus or hit a mall, do we sit there and acknowledge that we're winning this war by a wide margin, not only on the battlefield, but if you look at research and polling across the Middle East and South Asia, you see that many publics in places like Lebanon, Pakistan, Egypt have no support for this movement. So they may win a battle. Our problem is going to be looking at this and saying, that doesn't mean they're winning the war. Let's ensure that we sort of keep our eye on the ball and not overreact.
A sense of perspective. I think it's you who said we've got 14,000 murders a year in the U.S., and we look at that differently. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking about the double agent who foiled al-Qaeda's latest bomb plot and where al-Qaeda's terror capacity really stands now. Philip Mudd is with us, a long career in the CIA and FBI, a lot in this region. He's now at the New America Foundation's Counterterrorism Strategy Initiative. And Bruce Hoffman is with us as well, a scholar of security studies and terrorism studies for a long time now at Georgetown University at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service there. Bruce Phillip, we've got lots of response from our listeners. I mean, you know, there's a whole range. I mean, Christopher says, clearly the only safe way to travel these days is naked. Naked Airways, who's with me? Linda says, I do not live in fear of these criminals. I know that death can come anywhere, anytime. I'm more likely to die falling down the flight of steps in front of my door than by a terrorist bomb. She writes, I'm more afraid of all the freedom we have lost in the name of protecting us. What about the balance right now, Bruce? Given that, okay, evidence that there is a threat out there versus compromises we've made on civil liberties in this country and the inconveniences, what do you think of the balance that we've got currently, Bruce?
Well, I think the balance is always being recalibrated in response to the threat. And, you know, we've seen this repeatedly at airports, for example, where we've had to ratchet up the security as the terrorist means of penetrating our defenses have improved. So I think it's always a balance. Thus far, I think we've been very successful. I mean, we've been successful, I think, preserving fundamental civil liberties, but also giving law enforcement and the intelligence community the tools that they need to protect us. And I think the key is not so much, whether freedoms are being eroded, but how strong the oversight is that this far-reaching legislation is reviewed, that we have to be assured that there's justification for it. And, you know, in that sense, I think that our democracy is functioning entirely properly.
Well, Philip Mudd, do we ever get to go back to pre-9/11 openness?
I think that's a political question. It's not a security question. I mean, look, I'm first an American citizen and second a CIA and FBI professional. I look at this and say, at some point, we ought to have a political conversation with the American people that says, we can't let these guys win. This is the land of the free and the home of the brave. It's not the land of the secure. And in free societies, sometimes security comes second. So I think you have to start a conversation so that when something goes off in an airplane or at a bus station or a mall, not everybody says, how'd you miss that one? Because in a free society, you're going to miss a few of them. You got to just accept it.
Bruce, you've observed after, for example, the Virginia Tech shooting, students didn't stop going to universities.
No, that's right. I mean, this is, I think, why terrorism has endured for 2,000 years, is it has a very corrosive effect on society. It achieves, unfortunately, just as Philip said, exactly what the terrorists want, is they want to elicit an emotional response, an irrational response. They want to erode our civil liberties. They want to turn democracies into paranoid, xenophobic countries, and that's why we have to resist that. But at the same time, we do have to realize, too, that the threat terrorism poses is unique because citizens look to their government to protect them from violence and all kinds of threats. And again, it comes back to a balance, not only a balance between civil liberties and a security, but I think, as Philip said, a balance between understanding what's viable and what's possible, that we can't wrap ourselves in this false sense of security.
Let's go to Steve in Walpole, Massachusetts. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I'm just curious. We've talked a lot about what the constitutes winning for the United States in terms of basically taking these operatives out. But what constitutes winning from their perspective? What would tell them they have won if they get all of Westerners out of the Middle East, or what would tell them it's time to stop?
Yeah, what would sort of pull the fuel away? How about it, Philip? First to you.
I think one of the questions you have is, do they have the space to create the kind of society they want to create? They used to refer to Afghanistan as the first emirate in the reconstruction of the caliphate from, 1,300 years ago. So as long as they have no space to create the ideal society that they want to create, I think there's a potential. And I'm talking about for another decade or two or longer for people like this to say, we're unhappy, we want to oppose the near enemy, that is governments in places like Yemen and Egypt. And we want to oppose the foreign enemy, that is governments like the United States that support our local leaders. So I think they don't have that space now. They wanted to find it in Somalia. They haven't. They want to find it in the Sahel, that is places like Mali and Chad. They wanted to find it in Afghanistan, and they lost it. So I think we're in this for a long haul because they don't have the space to recreate this idyllic land.
What would that idyllic land look like? You've watched the traffic. You've read all the background. What is that picture of the ideal caliphate?
I don't think these guys know. And in fact, one of the problems they have in trying to recruit new support, that is fundraisers and just popular support across the Middle East, is people are increasingly saying, look, we don't like the Americans. In fact, we hate them. And polling data supports that. But we don't understand why to get rid of the Americans, you have to murder so many Muslims. So you had attacks against Muslims in places like Jordan and Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And increasingly, publics in these places are saying, you're not an answer either. And popular support for the Al-Qaedist movement has declined dramatically.
Ahmed in Montreal, Canada. Ahmed, you're on the air.
Yeah. Yes. Hi, Tom. Basically, I have 2 points. Mm-hmm. I'm becoming a bit cynical with the news from the government. Every time I feel there's a lot of fear-mongering to keep the war on terror going, especially it's an election year. My second point is, let's say it is true or what the government is stating. Why doesn't the government look at its own actions towards the region, Iraq, Palestine, Afghanistan, Pakistan? All the bombing that the U.S. is doing is against Muslim people. So there is going to be some blowback for that. And the government wants to stop their actions to stop the blowback.
Ahmed, we've got it. Bruce Hoffman, I mean, along those lines, I'm reading here Bruce Rydell writing just in the last few days. And of course, he's been right in the middle of U.S. Security efforts and monitoring in the Middle East. And he wrote in the Daily Beast, the Iraq War produced a generation of jihadists from across the Islamic world who were radicalized by the invasion and occupation of their country and turned to Al-Qaeda. And he writes, we will be dealing with the hatred fed by our strategic misadventure in Iraq for years to come. Kind of dovetails with what Ahmed's saying in Montreal there, Bruce.
Yes, but I think you have to look at all of these things individually and not aggregate them. I mean, it's true that Iraq, for instance, became a magnet for foreign fighters, for jihadis, that it played into Al-Qaeda's narrative that the United States and the West is waging a war on Islam, is invading Muslim territories. But let's go back to the 1990s. At the height of the Oslo Accords between the Israelis and the Palestinians, when cooperation between Israel and Palestine was blooming, when the Palestinian GDP was the highest it had ever been, when the prospects for peace seemed just within our grasp, that was exactly when bin Laden was blowing up the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. So, yes, it sometimes is a cause and effect, but other times it's very much the terrorist groups themselves using violence, firstly, for its cathartic appeal and cathartic violence, striking out against what they see as a foreign, internal, or alien force. And also, I think we have to understand from the terrorist point of view, winning, going back to the previous question, that, you know, winning for them is waging a strategy of attrition, is wearing us down, is wearing down our morale, is undermining our resolve, is affecting our economy. And that's why, you know, it's not quite fear-mongering. I think everybody would like to turn their back, draw a line under the war on terrorism, and go back to focusing on the key domestic issues that affect the United States today. But I think that's part of the problem, is we have to do both. I mean, the war on terrorism, certainly we've made tremendous strides in weakening Al-Qaeda and undermining Al-Qaeda, but it's not over yet. And I think, as Bruce Rydell said, it's right. It will be fought for another generation.
Philip Mudd, you weren't always a CIA agent or FBI. I think way back in the day, you were an English major. So when you look at this in U.S. policy, you know, what about this concern that policy is driving the very terror that we end up fighting at cost to civil liberties and all the rest?
I don't see that borne out in the facts. I mean, it makes perfect sense logically, but if you look at what's happening in the Islamic world today, you have a growing movement of people, and that's included both populations but also religious clerics. And I've talked to some about this, who say, look, you might have differences over what's happening in Iraq or what's happening in Palestine, but that doesn't give you the religious legitimacy to go out and murder innocent people in a street in New York City. So there are some technical issues here that are being debated in the Islamic world about the appropriateness of terror, and that allow us to say to people, not using our own voices, but using voices from people in the region, saying, look, it's okay to object to what the U.S. has done. It's not okay to then respond to that by figuring out how to murder somebody so that a child never go out without their parent in Detroit or New York.
How do you hold that line when Al-Qaeda and others of that ilk are circulating videos of the aftermath of American drone strikes with body parts laying all over? Or, you know what that's like. There's a lot of material out there circulating based on American military actions that just guaranteed to rile people up.
It is guaranteed to rile people up, but it's lost a lot of legitimacy. Hmm. We were facing serious struggles, in particular in Iraq a few years ago, over the photos out of Ghraib. Mm-hmm. I remember talking to Abu Ghraib, the prison sure. where there are abuses of detainees. I remember talking to some detained terrorists about this. They were very emotionally wrought up about this. They weren't necessarily real al-Qaeda members, the kinds of guys we were picking up at mm-hmm. al-Qaeda Central in Pakistan in 2002, but they were very disturbed by this.
It's terrible.
That's right, but what I'm saying is if you look at the decline in support for al-Qaeda murder, they've murdered far more Muslims after 9/11 than non-Muslims, and this is just losing credibility of their message. So I take the point that policy motivates some people to anger. But the facts suggest that al-Qaeda's ideology, like their operational capability, is declining quickly.
Benjamin's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Benjamin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask why it was that the coverage of Ibrahim the master bomb maker mm-hmm. is always covered as master bomb maker. I mean, it seems that his bombs haven't blown up. And is this really a media issue of coverage? And also, is it about the evidence that the state of al-Qaeda's effectiveness is diminishing?
That's a good question. Bruce, first to you. I mean, you can read this all over the place, and I assume people are getting it from American security circles, you know, master bomb maker. But then we saw the Christmas bombing didn't happen. This one, you know, gets handed off to a double agent. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, people are saying it was a high-grade military explosive. It's got a two-way detonation capacity now. Is this a master bomber or a made-up sort of media figure?
Right. Well, you've got to separate the components of a terrorist operation. On the one hand, you have, let's say, the engineering person, which is al-Asiri, whose cleverness and innovation isn't only in the explosive material, but in how it's concealed and how it can be used to evade detection. And there, I think he does earn the title of a master bomb maker.
We've heard at least one of his bombs described as a thing of beauty. Of course, you know, that's just by admiring its technical finesse.
Well, the worrisome thing about him is that he doesn't have one signature. He's constantly getting better. I mean, he's one of the few people who actually learns, unfortunately for us, learns from his mistakes and is able then to absorb them and to compensate for them. I think the other side of the operation, as you describe, is that the bombs may have been brilliant, but the execution of the operations has serially been flawed. I mean, Abdulmutallab, the passenger on board the Northwest Airlines mm-hmm. flight on Christmas Day 2009, failed to detonate the bomb. My understanding is that the bombs that were on DHL or UPS cargo flights a couple of years ago were actually a dry run, that they weren't the real thing, so that wasn't a failure. But, you know, we've been enormously fortunate, at least, in interdicting the operation. But as I said before, terrorists play the odds that they're hoping that after all of our successes, they're going to achieve one single destructive blow that's going to reverse our record of success and once again set in motion the fear and anxiety that they crave and exploit. And that's why someone like al-Asiri is so dangerous, because he has that capability, he has that innovative style that at least AQAP believes he'll deliver them that success.
Philip Mudd, I mean, here's al-Asiri. His bomb blew up his own brother on the way to try and hit the head of intelligence in Saudi Arabia. So master bomb maker?
Yeah, I think he is, actually. I would dispute some of the caller's comments for simple reasons. The first is, you'd be surprised when you look at this from the inside how few people there are like this around the al-Qaeda movement. I'm talking about people with the scientific or engineering skill, background, training, interest to develop devices like this. You would think there'd be tens or dozens. There just aren't. So whether or not every bomb functions perfectly, the number of bomb makers is few. And these kinds of people on the radar that I used to live with are way high up. The second thing I would say is, from a practitioner's perspective, a few of them might not go off, but they went off in Madrid, in London, mm-hmm. in Bali, in Jakarta, in Istanbul, in Amman, Jordan, in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, in Baghdad, Iraq over the past years. You can't afford to sit back and say they keep making mistakes. These guys are amateurs. You got to respect your adversary.
So,
and also, I mean, think of the determination that he deployed his brother with a bomb concealed up his rectum mm-hmm. in an assassination attempt that... You know, I mean, this is someone who's got ice water running through his veins, and also...
And he almost got his target, right? It went off just very near the Saudi intelligence chief.
Precisely. I mean, it worked as intended. It blew up his brother, Abdullah, but unfortunately, it failed to kill the minister. There wasn't enough explosives.
What do you see coming? I mean, people in the U.S. are already freaked out by the deep pat-downs they're getting in American airports, and here's this underwear bomb that's supposed to be form-fitted, custom-made, hard to perceive in a pat-down. Is it going to get more invasive, aggressive, Bruce?
Well, it's, you know, it's hard to say how much physically it can go past what's going on now, that technologically the improvements have kept us safe, but this is part of the problem, and it illustrates how the war on terrorism is still ongoing, is that as good as we have been, our adversaries, and especially someone like al-Siri, has shown himself capable of staying. It only has to be a half step ahead of us. But it shows that, firstly, it's very difficult to deter these people, and that, you know, the price of relaxing our vigilance or dropping our guard is unfortunately going to be a tragedy.
What do you think, Philip Mudd? Deeper pat down still on the other side of this, or can the scanners pick it up?
I don't foresee deeper pat downs, but what I think we need to have is a sophisticated, a simple understanding of what we expect as American people. Look, I fly all the time. I've got 11 nieces and nephews. I don't want to take my shoes off. If we go down that route, though, we have to have an understanding that people like me aren't going to go before a congressional committee when we miss one and have everybody say, how'd you get it wrong? And then the next day they say, well, we want fewer security measures. You can't have your cake and eat it, too.
Well, here we are, everybody absorbing this latest story and trying to move beyond the full-on paranoia and still be smart. Philip Mudd at the New America Foundation spent decades with the CIA and FBI. Philip, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Bruce Hoffman at Georgetown University, also decades in the field. Bruce, we're grateful for your insights today. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.